When you're ready, let's start this game.
Welcome to BCPL Unstacked, and let's unwind with award-winning New York Times bestselling author Kevin J. Anderson. Let's see what Kevin is reading, about his writing process, and all about his latest releases, including Stake and the latest Dune, The Duke of Caladan. Hey, this is Sarah.
And this is Stephen. Welcome. It's good of you to join us.
Hi there. Boy, am I glad to see you guys. I was very mystified here.
We're so glad you're able to join us, and we just have a series of questions.
Okay, that's fine with me. And in fact, it's great because my publishing house, Wordfire Press, we're kind of shifting over to have a full-on outreach to libraries to get libraries to pick up our books. I'm a professor. I teach a master's degree in publishing for grad students for Western Colorado University. And one of the things that I have my students do is each one of them goes from start to finish and republishes a long-lost public domain work by some classic, Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, whatever. And so we're producing this line of classics just because they're public domain so that the students can do them. But the thing that we're discovering is, oh, wow, libraries actually want these things. So we publish them in hardcover, and they're very beautiful editions of, last year we just published The Complete War of the Worlds, which is H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, and an unauthorized sequel in the 1908 called Edison's Conquest of Mars, written by, this was before copyright law, so this was written by somebody, this unauthorized sequel that was hugely popular. Thomas Edison goes to Mars to stop the Martian invasion. And then H.G. Wells himself wrote a sequel called Star Begotten. And we just put all those together in one big fat volume called The Complete War of the Worlds. And one of my other students did Alexandre Dumas, The Three Musketeers and The Man in the Iron Mask. He wrote one of the very, very first werewolf novels ever published. And it's been long out of print. And it's called The Wolf Leader. And we just republished it with an introduction by Jonathan Mayberry, a big New York Times bestselling author, because that was one of his favorite books as a kid. So anyway, that I'm way off on a tangent here, but I'm excited with the library outreach just because these books that we're doing, they're beautiful things because that's their student thesis project. It's this big, beautiful book, but it's not just a keep yourself busy and get a master's degree thing. These are real valuable works that we're bringing back in. And you know,
yeah, I can see a lot of libraries wanting to add them back, and there are several of them that I now want to read, so that would be great. Well, the first question is to introduce your newest titles to our listeners.
Okay, well, I've got, this is kind of the year of Dune. I've spent 21 years with Brian Herbert, Frank Herbert's son, and he and I have done a lot of new projects based on his father's wonderful science fiction universe. And there's just a whole lot of stuff going on right now because there was supposed to be a really big legendary motion picture coming out in a few weeks. That was going to be the winter blockbuster movie starring like every famous actor who's ever lived. And it's this huge movie, but because of COVID and everybody closing down movie theaters, they've postponed that wisely, I think, because you want people to go to the movie theater. But that didn't stop the rest of the train from going because Brian and I have a brand new novel called Dune, The Duke of Caladan. This is it's a immediate prequel. It takes place a year before Dune. So it's sort of like a family reunion before the movie comes. It lets you meet all the characters and just kind of get deeper into who they are and how their relationships work. And it's a big adventure too. And we also are doing a monthly comic book called House Atreides. It adapts the very first prequel novel that Brian and I did. So that's for Boom Studios. And the first issue just came out. And it's really fun to adapt this 20-year-old novel into 12 comic issues, which is all, you know, visual and exciting. That really has done well. The first printing sold out at the distributor level. So they went into a second printing and that sold out. And then they went into an unprecedented third printing. Now remember, these are monthly issues. It's like a monthly magazine. Once the month's over, you don't see it anymore. So to do three printings is pretty impressive. And issue number two comes out, I think, in a week or so. And that already just went into a second printing because it's selling so well. And then the third really big thing is Brian and I adapted Frank Herbert's original classic novel, Dune, into a faithful, definitive, scene-by-scene adaptation graphic novel from Abrams books, which library people certainly know about Abrams books. Big, beautiful graphic novel, and it'll be in three volumes, just the way Frank's novel is in three separate parts. And that was the number one bestseller on Amazon in its category last week. So I got a little screenshot to prove our little ribbon on it and everything. So anyway, lots of Dune stuff going on right before this interview. I've been busy editing The Lady of Caladan, which is our next book, comes out next October. But, you know, you got to write them before they can publish them. So we're working a year ahead of time here. Even though there's a pandemic, that doesn't stop us from doing all of our work. We're still busy working away here.
I think you also have another book out that just came out here this last October.
So here's sort of some background that I like to read all kinds of stuff, which means I like to write all kinds of stuff. I don't like only write vampire, steampunk, romance, mysteries. I write like whatever sounds good to me. And the big Dune stuff is huge science fiction, space opera. I have a giant fantasy trilogy that I'm finishing book three on right now, kind of like Game of Thrones, only different because mine is actually finished and I'm finishing the last book right now. But the one that you just showed up there, Stephen, is called Stake. And that's sort of an X-Files creepy vampire serial killer thriller. But here's the cool thing. We've got a couple of main characters. One, the main character believes in vampires. And so he thinks he's saving the world by tracking down vampires and killing them. The problem is, what if vampires aren't real and he's really just killing people who are like night workers and security guards and stuff who are perfectly innocent people that don't deserve to have a stake through their heart? So you've got a police detective who's like, who's this nutcase running stakes through people's hearts? And our main character, the third main character, is somebody who runs a sort of an I want to believe conspiracy website, that she's had some weird, unexplained things happen in her life. So she's willing to believe that the supernatural might be out there, but you've got to prove it to her. And then this vampire killer guy is writing her website, making his case, sort of like a Hannibal Lecter guy. And he's making a pretty darn compelling case that these are really vampires. Of course, the cop thinks the guy's nuts, and she really doesn't know. And because this is a Kevin J. Anderson novel, the reader really doesn't know either, because in my books, vampires usually do exist. So I kind of keep you guessing all the way through.
I really enjoyed it as well. And I was guessing the entire way. I was like, is it a vampire hunter or is it a serial killer? It bounced back and forth the whole book. And I've also been
up and it's all a dream at the end. So that's how it
goes. Spoiler alert.
No thanks. Don't do that.
I've been interested in true crime as well. And I was wondering, and my fascination with true crime has been kind of how your character Blair mentioned that there's real monsters in the world. And is there any true crime that may have influenced the book as well? Or do you have a favorite creature from folklore? Like vampires folklore. And like, is there a favorite?
Well, you know, the funny thing with vampires is I remember when my first book was published in 1988, and I remember kind of having an argument with somebody in like 1991 or 1992, this person saying that nobody's ever going to publish another vampire book because we're all tired of vampires and nobody wants to read about vampires anymore, and it's all been told, and here we are 2020 and we're still doing more vampire stuff. So the different incarnations of vampires are really fascinating to me. And also werewolves. But if you actually step back, the werewolf, the man who's like normal, mild-mannered person during the daytime, and then a full moon comes out, turns into this monster. Well, you don't have to take that literally. That's pretty metaphorical. The John Wayne Gacy's and the Jeffrey Dahmer's and the people that work in everyday normal life who are just truly utter monsters in reality. And that to me is more terrifying than, you know, some furry monster chomping through the forest. You know, I've always preferred the fantastic elements in my stuff. I don't really want to do just normal real world stuff because I live in the real world and I want to do made up things with kings and castles and Wizards and Dragons. And I had a creative writing teacher. I grew up in small town Wisconsin, which is really like Norman Rockwell, Ray Bradbury, very, very boring, very small farming town. Nothing ever happens. It was near the college that I went to, and I'm always writing these space epics and fantasy, find the magic sword and kill a demon kind of things. And my creative writing professor was very, very, very mundane. That's the term we use for people that don't like science fiction fantasy. He was very mundane. And he was like yelling at me like, Anderson, why do you always write stories like this? Why don't you write a story about this young guy who grew up in a small town in Wisconsin and he's going to college? And I just looked at him with this horrified expression on my face. And I said, I live that every day. Why on earth would I want to write something like that? So that's kind of been my background as a writer, that I'm not that big on slice of life mainstream things, because, you know, when I read, I want to go somewhere else. I don't want to, if I'm going to read about somebody whose life is like mine, why don't I just live my own life?
Touching on kind of her question, Stake does deal a lot with conspiracy theories. They're throughout the entire novel there. Do you have a conspiracy theory that you're all in on?
That I'm all in on?
Yes.
Oh, boy, that's dangerous stuff to say. Conspiracy. I turn on the news and I just slap my forehead and I go, what's wrong with you people? So actually, let me back up, because I worked for the X-Files and was very successful working for the X-Files. I did 3 novels, number one bestseller. I had like lines out the door for my book signing. I actually had people with literal tinfoil hats because they were afraid aliens were beaming thoughts into their heads and stuff like that. And this was in mid-1990s, I think. This was before the internet was really, there was the internet, but it wasn't that big of a deal. And there was no, Genie was out. I don't even think MySpace was out yet. There was certainly no Facebook, no Twitter, no social media. And then when the X-Files came on, it just took the whole country by storm, took the world by storm, just because Mulder, with all these conspiracy theories and UFOs, it was all like, wow, this is fascinating. It's the chupacabra and it's the aliens with their anal probes. And it's all, and this was all kind of new stuff for us. And it was funky that this one hard fighting FBI agent was the one who believed in the conspiracy theories. And of course, every single episode, he turned out to be right because it's TV, right? That's where we were in the 1990s. And now we're in a place that we are so inundated with the wackiest QAnon child pornography rings in the basement of a pizza parlor that any moron can look and find the pizza parlor doesn't have a basement. And then when the X-Files came back again a couple of years ago, it had its reboot, it came back. And I don't want to criticize it, but my wife and I watched, we just went, this just doesn't feel right anymore. It's just not that interesting. And it took me a while of analysis to realize that conspiracies aren't that interesting anymore. They're all around us and we're tired of them. You know, the COVID conspiracies that are going on now and these election conspiracies right now. And I just want to, come on, guys, get out of your bubble. It made writing Stake so much more interesting because I've dealt with crazy trolls before. I've dealt with crazy conspiracy theorists before. I've got a scene in there where the main character, the woman, there's a troll, there's a stalker who is threatening her. And so, and she's got a very big website audience. And she says, you know, maybe I should get a handgun just to have in my house to protect myself. And so she posts, what kind of handguns should a person like me get just so I can put it at my bedside? And she gets 20,000 responses of people. And she makes this comment that's like, gee, if I ask for what kind of fishing pole should I buy, what kind of response would I get? And the funny thing is that's exactly, I mean, I've gone shooting. I'm not a big gun person. I'm not a big gun hater. I just kind of, I don't care one way or the other. But when I was writing this scene in Stake, I wrote on my Facebook page, I said, I have a character who's afraid of being stalked and she needs to get basically a girl's handgun, something that she can pick up and go bang. Nothing that's complicated, nothing she has to assemble. And which one should I get? And I was expecting to get like a dozen recommendations or something. Really and truly, 20,000 posts later, they're on and fighting and arguing. And then all these people were writing me saying, I'm so sorry about your friend. I will take her shooting if she needs to get experience. Should I stake out in front of her house to protect her in case this stalker comes by? And I'm writing going, guys, it's a character in a book. Look, I'm getting all emotional about it. I'm talking about all these other people getting so emotional about it.
No, and this was actually a question I was going to ask you, because I thought I could see in the book that there was a kind of a little bit of a parallel in our misinformation world of today and the conspiracy theories, that while yours were more the classic conspiracy theories, and then comparing them with
empires and UFOs and Loch Ness.
Yes. It's a more comfortable, cozy theory to be in. And as a librarian, we really value information literacy, and we really feel that that's getting more and more challenging just with the amount of vast content that's out online. So you answered my question without even me having to ask it. So that was
I've actually got a follow up on that with the libraries, because I was. You know, I feel like an old fart when I do you kids today don't realize how easy you have it, that kind of thing. Because I used to write a monthly column for a scientific technical journal. It was a materials research society, okay? And every month I wrote this little historical column about how nylon fibers were invented and how glass lenses for telescopes were poured and, you know, interesting things like that. And this was before I had the whole internet. So I would go to the library and spend an afternoon with every different encyclopedia, and I'd be looking up stuff and I'd copy it. Now it's so much simpler that I can stay at home and just Google stuff. Well, the problem being, when I went to the library and I looked up something in the Encyclopedia Britannica, it was pretty well verified. And if I looked up and said, when was Napoleon's birthday? Well, I could pretty much count on that information when I found it in the reference section in the library. Well, now when you look up on Wikipedia, which is this giant living document and anybody can change it, you don't know if you've been punked or not. I read about this high school teacher whose students would ask them to do whatever, some term paper, and they would all come back to him citing references from Wikipedia. And he did this lesson to them that I thought was quite amazing. He said, okay, I'm going to show you just how unreliable this stuff is. And so as a class, they went to the Wikipedia entry for Cameroon or some little country in Africa. And they called up the listing for Cameroon and they rewrote it entirely and just plain made crap up. Greatest import is dinosaur eggs, and that the farming was pineapple trees, and they just made it up. And then every day they would look at that Wikipedia page, and it took 41 days before anybody caught it and corrected it. And he said, so look, guys, in these 41 days, anybody who looked up the country of Cameroon on Wikipedia was getting utterly false information. Well, that's kind of what STAKE is about, that there's false information all over the place, but you can find what you need to find to verify your own beliefs. And the problem is people only look to find things that verify their own beliefs rather than look to find things that are verified facts.
We do occasional news stories on the podcast, and we had talked recently about John Boyne, who had written The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. And in his new book, he's trying to research ways to poison people. And when he did a quick research, he pulled up information not knowingly about from the Legend of Zelda games, you know, ingredients that he had typed into in the novel that are from the game that he was thinking were actual ingredients for poisoning from historical records. And it's just that easy kind of, it's that fast, quick research that doesn't necessarily, as you're saying, get you where you need to be.
Well, and then we get problems, whereas we're really, really insistent on this thing we call the First Amendment, that there's freedom of speech. So you have the freedom to lie to people and tell them it's a fact. You have the freedom to write misinformation wherever you want. You know, the way to solve it is to make that not a freedom, that, wait a second, if you say something about somebody that is untrue and dangerous, you can be penalized for it. I'd kind of like something like that, because I'd like to be able to know that this is true when I'm reading it. But I don't see that happening anytime soon. And please don't write in and call me a fascist or something like that. I'm just Vampires. Let's go back to vampires, a safer subject.
We, Sarah and I actually have a side bet going on. Are we going to see more novels coming out in the staked universe?
I intended that to be just one. I mean, with the way it goes through and ends it and everything, my agent and my Hollywood manager are just kind of like going, no, there's a lot more, right? You've got a whole series planned. And I said, well, no, did you read the ending? It's done. And they go, well, no, there's much more. So I guess the answer will be, so I've got a side bet with my manager. There, sell steak for $1 million, and then we'll see if we can make it into a series or not. But I'm happy with it as a one-off. I don't know how I could sustain that. Is it real or is it not real for another book and then another book and then another book? But I've got ideas for what I could do for the next one. I mean, I think Blair is a very interesting character, and I'd like to do some more with him. And he's got some deep secrets, and who knows what sort of conspiracy he might be involved in. See, the thing is, I have to go off to the Dune universe or my Spine of the Dragon universe to clear my palate with dragons and giant sandworms when I'm like immersed in all these conspiracy theories. And it just gets kind of ugly. I mean, I interacted with some pretty nasty trolls, and I had people that just wanted to come kill me because I didn't believe that there were lizard people secretly running the entire government. Sorry, people, if you think they're lizard people running the government, I don't personally buy it. So I don't like working in the real world. I like working on, again, a galaxy far, far away or something like that. It's telling stories. It's more fun.
Since we are a library podcast, do you have any favorite library memories?
Let's see. Because I grew up in this very small town in Wisconsin, we didn't have a library. We had the bookmobile, and the bookmobile drove around once a month. I would, as a little kid, I had a kid's library card. And whenever the bookmobile would come and park in the bank parking lot, and it was like 2 miles away, and I'd hop on my bike and I'd ride down and go check out my library books. And I'm sorry, this is a sort of a negative library memory, but it's a bookmobile, so they don't have that much selection in there. And it didn't take me very long to blitz through every single book in their kids section. And they had this little science fiction section that had Arthur C. Clarke and Edgar Rice Burroughs and these classics. And I was like 9 or 10 years old, and I just had the kids library card. And I remember that I really, really wanted to check out a book called The Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke. It's like 1954, and like the most innocuous kid and his parents are colonists on Mars, and he finds an alien that he gets as a pet. But I wanted to check this out, and I took it up to the desk with the bookmobile librarian, and she wouldn't let me check out the book. She said, this is only for grownups. You can't read it. And I was just so angry and so disappointed, because, I mean, I was ready to read Arthur C. Clarke at 10 years old. And I came back home and I was really upset, and my mom could see I was upset, and I told her what had happened. So she drove me back down to the bookmobile, and she yelled at that librarian and said, you let him check out whatever book he wants. And so I got to check out my book. So for kids living in an isolated place like that, the bookmobile was just this lifeline that came every 3 or 4 weeks, and it was just a bunch of books that came, and we loved it.
Awesome. And yeah, now we don't have any limitations for children's cards and adult cards, primarily for that reason, because everyone knows what they want to read and what they're ready for.
You wanted to segue from politics, though, so we're going to segue away from Earth politics to go into Arrakis politics in a way. Dune is a complex series, and for people that are unfamiliar with it, where would you kind of advise them to start?
Well, I always tell people to start with Dune, the original one. I mean, Dune is like the Lord of the Rings for science fiction, that every single person should read Dune. If you've never read another science fiction novel, read Dune. I mean, that's just, it goes without saying if you're going to do that. But if you're going to go beyond reading the original Dune, we've got a couple of entry points. And I guess if you read Dune, maybe my advice would be to go and read our prequel trilogy, the House Atreides, House Harkonnen, and House Carino, because it's the the story of Duke Leto and Lady Jessica and the Baron Harkonnen. So it's sort of the backstory of all the characters you see in Dune. And that's probably the easiest way to step into it. After 21 years, Bantam Books has now just reissued them with brand snazzy new covers, and they all just came out now. So I'm sure your libraries have just all bought new copies. That's where I would recommend. We've got, I think, 15 Dune novels so far, and they're all, instead of just being this endless series where you can't dip into it, Brian and I like to write discrete stories, like a trilogy in this time period and a trilogy in that time period, so that you can read 1, 2, 3 and then be done and then move on to something else. I, for one, have a little hard time jumping into a series when I know that it's 15 books long and do I have to read them all? So this is a different approach for us, that we give you a lot of different, kind of like the different Star Trek series. You can watch Voyager, you can watch Deep Space Nine, you can watch Next Generation, you can watch Discovery, and all these different things like that.
Obviously, because it is such a large series, it's a lot of details. It's an intricate world. So how do you keep all the details that you need for each upcoming novel there?
By reading them over and over and over and over and over again. Just before doing The Duke of Caladan, I went through, I think, 7 of the unabridged audiobooks. We have a little gym in our house, which is good now with COVID. So I have a little gym in my house, and every morning when I work out, that's like an hour's worth of audiobook that I can listen to. And, you know, you do it at like 1.5 speed, so it goes faster. And now these are books that I've written 20 years ago, 15 years ago. So I'm listening to them again. And it gives me this nice perspective that you don't have when you're actually, like right now, Lady of Caladan is on that's third draft. So I've read it 3 times in a row, all the way to the end, back to page one, all the way to the end, back to page one, all the way to the end. And it's a little hard to get much perspective on it when you keep doing that. And in fact, in a couple of days, I'll be done with this draft. And then it goes off to Brian for his turn while I go off and edit my third Spine of the Dragon book. So it's nonstop around here, but it's just constantly editing something. And then when you reread something of your own after 10 years, 12 years, it gives you this great, oh, I forgot about that, and interesting details.
And kind of touching on that, I've read that you kind of share a similar philosophy in a way. It's kind of why we're doing this interview right now, is because you believed in taking shots in the dark. And just, if you had a dream that you kind of wanted to do, take that shot. That's how we got messages out to you. You were on our wish list, so we took a shot there. And you kind of did the same thing with getting into the Dune world building. And I'd love for you to be able to tell us again the serendipitous tale of how you came to co-author the continuation of Dune.
Well, Frank Herbert wrote 6 Dune novels. His after Dune, then he wrote 5 sequels. And the last one was called Chapter House Dune. Frank had pancreatic cancer, just like Alex Trebek. And Frank wrote Chapter House Dune, which was meant to be Heretics of Dune, Chapter House Dune, and then Dune 7, his last one, was meant to be another big trilogy. But Frank passed away from pancreatic cancer right after Chapter House was finished. And Chapter House just ends on a Luke, I am your father kind of cliffhanger. It's this big, everybody's just left hanging there. It's a terrible situation. And then Frank had passed away. And as a Dune fan, I was just like desperate. What's the story? What's the end of this story? Now, I read Dune, I think, when I was 11 years old for the first time. And then I reread it in high school, and then I reread it in college, and I reread it, you know, over and over again. Frank was always like my invisible mentor, because I read not just the Dune books, I read all of Frank's books, The Destination Void and Eyes of Heisenberg and Hellstrom's Hive and all these other books. And he was just, I studied how he wrote. I loved how he plotted things and did world building. And when I sold my very first novel, I was able to join the Science Fiction Writers of America, which is our big professional organization. And you have to be a professional to join it. And by selling my first novel, I was a professional. And one of the things that you get is their membership directory. And so I got Frank Herbert's home address, and I was going to send Frank a signed copy of my first novel because I loved his work so much, but he died before my book could be published. So I never had a chance to do that. All along, I published my own books and I was nominated for various awards. And then I started working for Star Wars and built a pretty solid career for myself. And Brian Herbert himself was also a very respected science fiction author. He had a whole bunch of books published. And in fact, Frank Herbert's very last published book called Man of Two Worlds was a collaboration with Brian. So they started working together just toward the end when his health was failing. And I just kept, you know, I was very successful. I had more books than I could possibly write under contract. I was busy all the time, but it just kept nagging at me in the back of my mind. Like, how did this Dune story, how is it supposed to end? And how does it wrap up? And did Frank Herbert leave any notes, or what was going on there? And why wasn't Brian Herbert writing this book? I wanted him to write this book. In the science fiction field, everybody knows everybody, or it's like one degree of Kevin Bacon. Everybody knows somebody who knows somebody. And it wasn't really hard for me to find a contact for Brian Herbert. And I wrote him a letter that was a shot in the dark. I just said, you know, how much I loved the Dune books, how much I loved Frank Herbert's writing, and how much they meant to me. And was there any chance he was going to finish this Dune story? And if he wasn't ready for it, could we maybe work on it together? And so, I mean, I'd never met him before. I'd never seen him, never talked with him. And I just sent this letter off. And apparently my letter arrived coincidentally, exactly on Frank Herbert's birthday. And then Brian kind of mulled it over for a couple of months. I mean, I thought he wasn't going to answer because I never heard anything back. And then he just called me up out of the blue one day and we started talking. And again, I'd never spoken to him before. And my wife was in the room and she said, you guys started talking. And after about 30 seconds, you began speaking a different language, that we would finish each other's sentences. We would be riffing off of obscure details in some Frank Herbert novel that nobody remembered. I mean, this was really, really very quickly we decided that this was, we were a good team and we could work together. And so we brainstormed some more, and then I flew up and spent like 4 or 5 days at his house where we brainstormed even more. And we've since written 3 or 4 million words together and 15 bestsellers and a bunch of awards. And so I think it's turned out okay.
I think so too.
What is it like working in a collaboration to be like an independent writer as well as working with others? Because you've done several collaborations.
Well, I mean, I've collaborated on like 30 books with my wife, and we've been married 29 years, so that's worked okay. I've collaborated with Dean Koontz on something. I've collaborated with lots of other people. You have to be partnered with somebody that you respect and that you like respect their ideas, because all of this is it's a collaboration. You're working together on the same thing. You're playing with each other's toys, and you know, it's Brian and I will brainstorm the whole thing together. We'll spend days just going over here's the book and start to finish and throw things out. We'll go for hikes and just keep rattling off. How about if this happens, or how about if that happens? And after several days, it's pretty much crystallized into a real outline and a form, and we break it down into chapters. Say it's 100 chapters in a Dune book, as it often is. We tend to take storylines. Like, I'll take this character and he'll take that character, and we'll go through and then split them up, so that if it's 100 chapters in our outline, he'll do 50 of them and I'll do 50 of them, and we go off into our own corners and write our own drafts, and then we put the whole draft together like this giant patchwork quilt. And then one person goes, all right, we've got this. One person goes from start to finish and starts, you know, I mean, a lot of things don't fit because we're all writing our independent chapters. And then we plow through it. I call that part kind of like going through a jungle with a spoon for a machete. Clean it up as much as you can. And then we send it off to the other person, who then cleans it up. And then it goes back and forth. One of them, I think the Machine Crusade went 13 times back and forth. We usually do 5 or 6. Before it's pretty well smoothed out. I hope Lady of Caladan's only 5 or 6. It's reading pretty well right now. I should finish it in the next day or two and send it off to Brian.
When you take over for writing for somebody like Frank Herbert, it's obviously a long shadow to step out of, and you're not going to please everybody. And the same can be said with original writing. How do you handle the negativity that comes with critique and negative fandom?
Well, at the beginning, it's quite a shock because you don't realize that those sorts of people are out there. There's still a lot of it that is just plain incomprehensible to most people. Like for instance, I don't really like jazz music, but that just means I don't listen to jazz music. I don't go and attack and do death threats to anybody else who likes jazz music. I don't understand that attitude, but we have done so much stuff. Of course, remember I worked in Star Wars and I got trolls over there, and I worked in X-Files and I got trolls in tinfoil hats with that. And I got, they're all over the place, and you just realize it. And like right now, the Duke of Caladan came out, and I just looked at lunchtime today. So we, on some of the Dune sites, there are trolls. I this is book number 16 and I hate it. I despise it. I hate it as much as I've hated all the other 15 books. And I'm like, well, then don't read them. I mean, millions of people like them. If you don't like them, I'm sorry. I mean, I wish you did like them, but you know, go away. And then I look on Amazon at lunchtime today, and it's got almost 200 reviews now and a 4.5 star rating. So, you know, I'm writing for those people and not the people who hate things. And, you know, I sincerely mean that. I'm sorry if you don't like it. I mean, I wish you did like it. But if you don't like it, there, you know, go to the library. There are other books. What we have done in keeping Frank Herbert's legacy alive, we've gotten all of his books back in print. The original Dune books have been selling hugely well. The comics that we're doing, the graphic novel adaptation. Brian has like devoted his life to keeping his father's works around and still read. And we're building a larger readership for it. There are people that are using our books as sort of an introduction into the Dune universe.
Are you looking forward to the new Dune film? I actually haven't seen the David Lynch one, and I've only seen the documentary Jodorowsky's. I know. I've seen Jodorowsky's Dune.
You're living under a rock. So how could you have seen Jodorowsky's Dune but not having seen the other stuff?
I usually like David Lynch as well, so I need to watch it.
Yeah,
she's actually led a program on Jodorowsky's Dune. Is what's even funnier.
Well, and I mean, I'm fascinated by the Jodorowsky's Dune.
Crazy. It's a crazy story.
I watched that and I just go, oh man, am I glad he didn't get to make that movie. I can't imagine what that movie would have turned out like. We're not really allowed to be talking too much about the
okay.
Movie. I'm really looking forward to it. I've seen looks terrific, and Brian and I are both consulting on it, so we've got some background in it, but we're very pleased, and we just hope this will be the best version of Dune ever, and we'll introduce lots more people to the Dune universe.
Yeah, the trailer looks beautiful.
Well, that was certainly a hit. 25 million views in 1 week or something like that. It was very, very happy.
And you said you kind of have some consulting in it. Do you have the same kind of relationship with the potential HBO Max, the Sisterhood of Dune?
Same thing, and the same thing. I can't talk about it. So. Let's just say that COVID has not allowed all the filming to go forward like we had hoped a year or so ago. So we'll, but they're finding all kinds of workarounds in Hollywood for, I'm seeing TV shows pop back up again. I go, wait a minute, how did you even film that? So there are ways. So I am an optimist.
Switching franchises then, the hot flavor of the month, obviously, is Mandalorian. And this second season, we see a creation from something that you had created in your novel, Darksaber. Do you still get a little bit of excitement of seeing little pieces of what you've done added to pop culture phenomenons?
Well, there was a lot of little things of mine in the newer Star Wars movies, the Solo movie and the Force Awakens and little things like that. And you know, I spot them and the super fans spot things like that. And there've been stuff in The Mandalorian, there was stuff in The Clone Wars. And, you know, I did an awful lot of work for Lucasfilm. And, but the way that works is that it's all a great big team. And so everything that I do just goes into the big toy box that everybody else gets to play with. My Darksaber is entirely different from their Darksaber. There's a negative black lightsaber.
I'm talking more because we see a pearl.
Yeah, well, the pearl that was in the illustrated Star Wars universe book that I did with Ralph McCoury. It was sort of like a big National Geographic in the Star Wars universe. And in A New Hope, you see this giant skeleton out in the desert, and it's a crate dragon skeleton. And so we were able to make up the whole background of the crate dragons in that book. And they used a whole bunch of that for the first episode of The Mandalorian. Of course, now the crate dragon looks like a giant sandworm for all my Dune stuff. So it all comes around and goes full circle, right?
Do they tell you when they're going to do stuff like that, or is it just kind of a surprise?
I sit and watch every... I haven't worked for them in quite a long time. Well, I have never worked for Disney, and I haven't worked for Lucasfilm in a long time. So now I sit in the movie theater and go, oh, I'm watching Solo, and oh, that's all the spice mines of Kessel and the Maw installation and the black hole cluster, and that's all my stuff, and that's great. And so it gets me my fanboy moments.
What is it like working on a graphic novel? Like, what is the process in building a graphic novel? Do you work with the artist? How does the writing go first? Does it go hand in hand with the illustrations?
Well, I've done a lot of comics work since back in the 90s of 50, 60 different issues of Star Wars and X-Files and Predator comics and Justice Society and things. So I'm used to writing comic scripts. I still read comics a lot. So I'm familiar with the format. And writing the script is, you do a page one, panel one shows this and here's the dialogue, and panel two shows this and here's the dialogue. And then you lay it out. So I usually write the script before the artist works on it. For the Dune stuff, of course, the artist spent a lot of time developing all of the uniforms and ships and Castle Caladan and all that kind of stuff. So that was going on as prep work ahead of time while I was writing the scripts. And then they have the script, and then we see little thumbnails as they're laying out the pages, and then we approve those, and then we see the detailed artwork and we approve that, and then we see where all the dialogue balloons are placed. It's a multi-step process.
You've been involved in numerous fandoms. You've talked about X-Files, you've talked Star Wars, you've done a Batman, Superman, Cold War story, you've worked with the Justice Society, you've worked with one of my favorite, 1970s detectives of Kolchak. Is there a brand?
Wow, you found the Kolchak one? That's really obscure, okay.
I love me some Kolchak. Back in I forget the year when they were trying to re-release it with Stuart Townsend and it was competing against Supernatural first season. I was really hoping that Supernatural was going to be the one that didn't make it and Kolchak was. And unfortunately, I was on the losing side there.
Well, I wasn't a huge fan of the reboot. I don't think it caught the magic of the CD Columbo detective attitude to it. But and I think Fringe was out at about the same time, too. So there was a lot of investigating weird stuff going on. So anyway, what's your question? I derailed you there.
No, you're fine. Is there a brand or a character that you haven't written yet that's on your wish list?
You know, people ask me that a lot, and I don't really have a lot of time to go chasing after something. I really did love my Batman and Superman stuff. I did two novels for DC, and we were going to do a third one, also set in the Cold War, Batman and Superman, and then Wonder Woman shows up. And I thought, Wonder Woman in the 50s. I mean, then imagine Wonder Woman, Diana Prince, and Lois Lane, and their tough, strong women who are always being called hun and pinched on the bottom and stuff like that. There's just a lot of interesting stuff going on there. But there was just, DC kind of canceled their book line for a while, so we never got a chance to do that one. And I guess what you have to understand, when you do these things, it's not like, okay, I'm going to just read some crib notes and write a Batman novel. It is months and months of reading mountains of Batman origin stuff and all of Frank Miller's stuff and all of the major Batman stories and all of the details and all of the, just to get Batman right. You don't just go, I'm going to write Batman today. When they give you a hiatus for 7 or 8 years, they go, sure, just jump right back in and do another one. Well, it's not that easy to just jump right back in. I've forgotten all these little tiny details. I mean, I couldn't write an X-Files novel right now. I've forgotten all of the little intrinsic stuff in there. Even Star Wars, a lot of people constantly ask me if I'm going to write anything new with Star Wars. Well, there have been probably 300 Star Wars novels and umpty-ump Clone Wars episodes and Rebels episodes. And to get it right for the fans, you got to have all of that stuff. You don't just like say, I'm going to ignore all of the Rebels episodes. You have to know all that to get the right little look and feel and details correct. And, you know, it's like Dune. I've been in Dune for so many years, and I think, well, fortunately, Dune is keeping me busy enough that I don't have to go surfing for other things. Like, if somebody offered me the definitive My Little Pony novelization, I'm not sure I'd get around to doing something like that.
How do you balance adding your own personal touches to those licensed works while still staying true to those things that have come before?
Well, you know, think of it as like writing a Star Trek episode for TV. If I was, I mean, I'm diehard classic Trek guy. I grew up watching that every day after I came home from school. And if I were hired to write a new Kirk, Spock, and McCoy episode, well, you have to be true to Kirk, Spock, and McCoy and do it all exactly like that. Or a Captain Picard and Data and Worf episode or something like that. The way to not do it correctly is to write your own story with your own character and just happen to have Luke Skywalker walk in and out every once in a while. There are some people who do that, where the whole story is about made up character number one. And you really want a story, and by you, I mean the fans really want a story about their favorite characters. And you have to get the sound right. You've got to get the dialogue right. You got to get the look and feel right. But, you know, if I were writing a story set in Dallas, Texas, I'd be constrained by the rules of what Dallas, Texas is like, what the climate's like, what the food is like, what the streets are like. I wouldn't be talking about the blizzards in the mountains of Dallas while I'm eating bratwurst and sauerkraut. That would not feel like Dallas to me if that's the way I wrote it. You'd have to get the rules of Dallas right. That doesn't mean it constrains your creativity. It just means that you have to color within the lines and do your best.
I have a question from our teen librarian, Sam. She would like to know, how did you get the idea for Dan Shamble, the Zombie PI series, which is kind of Monsters meets the Hard-Boiled Detective? And I'm currently on the first one right now.
Well, Dan Shamble is sort of like Kolchak the Night Stalker meets Spaceballs. I got to this point, and I almost remember exactly, I think it was when I was watching like one of the season finales of The Walking Dead, or when I was watching World War Z or something. And we watch all the zombie apocalypse stuff, and they're all gritty and everybody dies and it's all dark. And I watched it and just said, you know, I've seen enough of these. It's time for a funny and stupid zombie story. And it was kind of like time for Spaceballs. And I just, the jokes just write themselves. I mean, once you get into this situation where it's the monsters have come back. It's an alignment of planets and a whole thing that all of the legendary monsters come back. The vampires and werewolves and mummies and ghosts and frog demons and everything, they all come back. And they all live in a certain part of the city called the Unnatural Quarter. And after all the shock and stuff goes away, they just all have normal lives and they want to live their normal things. And this is a private detective who is working on, like, the werewolf wants to get a divorce, and the Alzheimer's zombie family wants to find the guy where he's wandered off to. And and so they're just sort of like normal cases, which makes it more ridiculous just because you've got mummies unraveling and you've got a vampire who thinks that somebody's trying to kill him because he sees pointed stakes everywhere. And you know, these are funny. I mean, they're meant to be stupid, Naked Gun, laugh out loud kind of things. And because I write so many big, serious stories, it's really a breath of fresh air for me to take a break and write a Dan Shamble book. So,
are we going to be seeing any of him shambling forth?
Whenever I get a chance. I mean, my schedule is so booked up. I mean, I've got the third in my Spine of the Dragon trilogy, and I've got The Lady of Caladan, and I've got a monthly comic, and I've got the Dune graphic novels, and I've written two steampunk fantasy adventures with Neil Peart, the drummer from Rush, who passed away last January. And he and I had plotted a third one, and all the notes are sitting there. His widow has given me her full blessing to write it. And I'm kind of gearing up to write that, called Clockwork Destiny. I'm kind of gearing up to write that starting in January or so, which will be the 1 year anniversary of Neil's passing. And that's kind of scaring the crap out of me because I love those other books so much and it raised the bar so high. So I've got that. And Dan Shambles, it's because we publish them ourselves, it has to be something that I fit in between paying gigs.
Speaking of Neil and the Clockwork series, I think you are one of the few people outside of maybe Coheed and Cambria that has done it the reverse of where it's normally done, where the album is influenced by literature. You have the novelization of an album, which is kind of a unique take. How did you get involved with Rush and the collaboration with Neil?
Well, my very first novel, Resurrection Inc., was inspired by the Rush album, Grace Under Pressure. That was back when I was like 25 years old and I just wrote my first novel and I got this new Rush album and I went, there's a cool story in here. And I put all sorts of secret lyrics all the way throughout the book. And when it was finally published, I had put an acknowledgement to Neil Peart, Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson in the front of the book. And when it was published, I just signed copies and mailed them off to Mercury Records and never expected anything ever again. But like a year and a half later, I got a letter back from Neil Peart that he had got it, he had read it, he loved it. And he asked if I wanted to keep corresponding with me, he'd welcome that. And so we were friends for like 31 years before he passed away. But anyway, when they were doing what turned out to be their last studio album, Clockwork Angels, it was all this big concept album, a big steampunk story with airships and alchemy and pirates and lost cities. And he kept firing me letters asking me, well, what about this? And what about that? And I mean, I'm brainstorming with like one of my idols of all time. And I thought this is really cool. And they're recording the songs. And my wife and I had lunch with him at a cafe in Santa Monica. And he was just so excited about, they'd recorded the first three or four tracks and he was so excited about it and the whole story. And he hadn't even finished writing all the songs yet, but he was just gushing and bubbling at lunch. And he just said, oh, this isn't just going to be an album. This is going to be a Broadway musical and it's going to be a novel and it's going to be Ice Follies and it's going to be, and I'm just a Rush fan just going, oh, cool, Ice Follies. My wife is listening and she just looks at him and says, Neil, you said a novel. Who's going to write the novel? And he said, well, Kevin is, of course. And then he goes on and about his Ice Follies. And so that's how he and I worked on Clockwork Angels, which became a New York Times bestselling novel. So Neil became a New York Times bestselling author because of that. And then he and I wrote a sequel called Clockwork Lives, which we think that's my favorite book of the 170 books that I've written. I think it's just my best one. It won the Colorado Book Award. And that's why when writing Clockwork Destiny, it's like, wow, I've got a big bar that I have to jump over. So, but it's coming up. It's kind of in the back of my mind, gearing up to that. Right now, my brain is, I've got my head in the sand. I'm writing Dune stuff.
When you're writing, you are often influenced by music, specifically bands such as Rush, Tool, Floyd. Do you have any current bands that are influencing your next book or any that influenced the Duke of Caladan?
Nothing specific. I mean, the thing is that I've just got such a large album collection. I'm kind of recycling all the stuff that I always played. And I'm not the sort going, I want to hear new music. So I'm not shopping around too much. I'm trying to remember the last new band that I jumped into that I got so excited about. And I mean, my mind, I'm like, scrolling across my CD rack. Yes, I do still have CD because I like to look at the Within Temptation is something I really love. That's sort of Northern European goth chick metal is what kind of like Nightwish. She beautiful operatic singer, heavy metal stuff, lots of great sound. I love them. There's one that's kind of cheesy, but I really do like that. It's called Dragon Force and it's like really pounding fast. And if I need energy when I'm writing, I'll put on Dragon Force and it's just like musical caffeine. Last couple of days, I just blitzed through all of the David Gilmour solo albums, then all the Roger Waters solo albums. And Kansas has a brand new album out that's really pretty good. It's their first one in like 8 years or something. So I keep waiting for my old fart favorite high school bands to come out with new stuff. And I'm sorry, I'm just kind of blanking on new things to go to, but.
Well, if you're into the Dragon Force, if you haven't tried Powerwolf, it's right up there with it.
How can it not be with a name like Powerwolf, right? I don't know. I listen to good stuff and I'm just to me, I like it on in the background so that it's like subliminally hitting me. Dragon Force is nothing subliminal about it. Camelot is pretty good. I listen to a lot of their stuff. So this is the obscure prog rock podcast.
I think Stephen would be happy to switch it to the prog rock podcast.
But... all day, every day.
We did two prog rock CDs of our own for my Terra Incognita fantasy trilogy. And one of my fans used to own a record label, Prog Rock Records. And I told him, this was before Clockwork Angels. And I said, look, I've always been influenced by music. I would love to have sort of a companion album with songs that highlight parts of the novel. And he made it happen. It was Sean Gordon at Prog Rock Records. And we, our group was called Roswell Six, and it just made it up, you know, there's, and it's a studio band, but we got, my wife and I wrote all the lyrics to the song. So we had people write the music to it. And I mean, I'm just like so geeking out that, Steve Walsh, the lead singer from Kansas, the guy who sang Carry On Wayward Son and Dust in the Wind, sings a bunch of our songs. And Michael Sadler from Saga sings a bunch of our songs. And James LaBrie from Dream Theater sings a bunch of our songs. And David Ragsdale, the violinist for Kansas, you know, Dust in the Wind, the violinist for Kansas, plays violin on our prog rock CDs. And I love these CDs. They're by Roswell Six. Seven people bought them, and so we didn't make a career out of that, but I'm sure you can find them on Spotify or something like that. I'm proud of them. So
we may have listened to a few of the songs before.
The little snippets, yeah. We could find. My last question for you is, what are you currently reading or watching?
Let's see. So we just last night finished watching the entire first series of Britannia, which is kind of a cool historical, it's on Epics. It stars the guy who was the governor on The Walking Dead, Romans fighting Druids in ancient Britain. And there's a little bit of a fantasy twist to it, kind of historical. That was pretty well done. We just watched a movie, Rotten Tomatoes rated it really high. And we were blown away by it. It's called Chronicle. It's one of the more interesting superhero movies I've seen. Stars Michael P. Jordan from Black Panther. I guess he's the sexiest man alive as of this morning. But that it's basically a couple of high school friends find some goo in a field and it gives them superpowers. But the whole thing is sort of like Blair Witch Project, that they're filming it with their own cameras, which turns me off. It was like the first 20 minutes was, I'm not sure I can get into it. But it turned out to be really good.
Definitely a darker take.
But it was really well done. I don't know what's on tap tonight. We've got a bunch of stuff recorded. We've got a little watch list. Everybody's telling me I'm supposed to watch The Queen's Gambit. I haven't the slightest clue what that's about, but everybody recommends it. So it's on the list and we'll see. Frankly, we've got time to watch stuff now. It's not like I go out partying every night.
If you get a chance, I recommend, it just came on Amazon. It was Truth Seekers. It's a Nick Frost, Simon Pegg kind of X-Files-y, ghost hunter-y kind of story. Okay. But with a little bit of British comedy, Malcolm McDowell is in there, and it's beautiful in its own little way. But you said, as you're sitting at home because of COVID, you have been a very involved in far as your community fan engagement, be it you were a mainstay at conventions, videos, bulletin boards, forums. Obviously, that's not happening right now. How has this past year changed the way that you keep up with your followers?
Well, much more focused on social media now. I mean, I'm Facebook, and I'm doing a lot of things like this. I'm doing 5-6 podcasts a week, it seems like, and video conferences. I used to do 3 science fiction conventions, comic cons, whatever, 2 or 3 a month. You know, it was like a all year long. I was just there meeting the fans and autographing books and collecting names for my newsletter. And I mean, it's all involved. And that just came to a screeching halt. Now that means that I get more chance to do writing. I'm spending more time in my own office. I miss it, but I also kind of like sleeping in my own bed instead of getting up at 4 in the morning and running to the airport 3 times a month. It is what it is. And it's complaining about it can't change it. So I'm kind of looking for silver linings and rolling with it. I don't know that if everything magically got over with, that I would suddenly jump into doing three conventions a month again, because I do kind of like having a little bit more time. I went camping three times this summer. I haven't gone camping three times in 20 years, probably. So, you know, I kind of like that, but I still keep in touch with the fans. I mean, I'm obviously on social media all the time, and Facebook and Twitter, and you know, I do what I can. See smiling faces, even though they're on a computer screen instead of in person.
I got one last thing. You mentioned that you've won a bunch of awards, but I want to talk about one award in particular that I saw that you had gotten in the past, and that was the Writer with No Future Award.
You didn't give me a chance to go and bring it. I've got it here in my office, so I should have had it to hold up. So, yes, I won a trophy called the Writer with No Future, because I could produce more rejection slips by weight than any other writer in an entire writing conference. And I keep that trophy as a reminder of how persistence pays off, because if I had, you know, let that get me down, I never would be where I am now. But it's also another little reminder of the importance is not in the awards, it's in the writing. And there are some people that just put so much importance in awards, and I don't campaign for awards and stuff anymore. It's nice to get one, but I'd rather have a fan letter from a fan.
I guess where I want to really know is that at some point, do you stop receiving rejection letters, or do you still get them to this day?
I still get some, but the thing that has turned around for me is that I usually sell books before I write them now. I mean, somebody asked me what write The Duke of Caladan, or write The Spine of the Dragon, or write the Batman Superman book. It's not like I just write a book and see if I can sell it somewhere. And the same thing with short stories. I don't have time to write short stories anymore. If I was writing short stories and mailing them off, then it might get rejected sometimes. But it doesn't happen that often, but it still does. There are still editors out there that don't see my brilliance right from the first page. So
I've really been enjoying your writing so far. So I'm really glad that Stephen set everything up, because I'm starting to read more of your work.
There's only 170 books.
Cross them off the list.
and there are still some short stories. I think we just got one in from a collection of horror things called At the Multiplex.
Well, that's a reprint. And I just did my own publishing house. We just released 4 volumes called Selected Stories, Kevin J. Anderson. So there's a 2 science fiction volumes and a horror volume and a fantasy volume that we just put all the short stories together. Your library must have a copy of all 4 of those. You need to order those. So that's all my short stories so far. You know, I still love what I'm doing, and I'm writing things that I'm really enjoying. I'm not doing stuff that I don't like. And, you know, I guess that's the best way to be in even in pandemic times.
It really is. We want to definitely thank you for your time of joining us here today.
Quick little plug, my own website, wordfire.com. I've got a readers group to sign up there, and you'll get it's not just a newsletter. You get some free books, and I've read aloud one of my stories with Neil Peart as a free download and some stuff like that. So sign up and you can keep in touch with me, and that way tell your libraries which books to buy. Thanks both of you and everybody listening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for joining us at the BCPLN Stacked. Copies of Stake, Dune, The Duke of Caladan, and Death Warmed Over, and so many more are available in the library collection for listeners who are looking for their next read.
Or they can be purchased through your favorite bookstore and online vendors. Visit wordfire.com for more about Kevin J. Anderson's work. Stay safe and read, my friend. It's good for you. Bye.
Bye.